Hello and welcome to Misbehave, the podcast where we explore human behavior in a business context. Season 2 of Misbehave is all about uncovering behavioral patterns which create success in life and business. We're joined by highly driven, accomplished individuals to assess their behavioral patterns and dive into how behaviors have influenced their journey. In this episode of Misbehave, we talk to Aditi Sarana, a behavioral analyst and high performance coach to global leaders. Aditi opens up about the behaviors that hold leaders back, the role of energy in workplace productivity, and the similarities in high-performing leaders. Well, welcome, Aditi. We're so pleased to have you with us today. I think let's start with, you started your entrepreneurial journey at just 18 years old. Tell us a little bit about how those early experiences that you had as an entrepreneur shaped your understanding of behavior and productivity in the workplace and the work that you do now.
First of all, being a behavioral analyst myself, being in front of two of you and knowing that I will be analyzed at the end of this conversation, super exciting. So thank you so much for having me over. Rarely do I get an opportunity to be able to be on this side of the table. So I'm very, very happy. It started my entrepreneurial journey in a very dramatic situation. And for that, you have to know the context of Indian culture. Like in India, girls specifically, if not boys, but both of us, but like mostly girls are never allowed to move out of their houses until we get married off. Like that's like a very strong cultural reference. And 20 years back, it was even stronger when I was, 19. And that time I told my father that I want to pick up psychology as a career, which didn't have any career prospects in India. There's very few people who had the courage and the money to survive in a profession like this. So my father freaked out, but he couldn't have shown me that he's freaking out. So he got upset and he said, "You can't do this." But I was really insistent. So he said, "If you want to do this, you can leave my house right now," which was 10 p.m. in the night. Now, little that I knew is I was so passionate. Now I can't imagine jumping on that decision so quickly. But I said, "Yes, exactly what I want to do. And if that means leaving your house, I will." So I left his house and had to become an entrepreneur because I didn't have any other choice. I knew only the work that I do. So it was only moving forward. So because I left, I figured out who are the people I can go and talk to and who would see value in behavioral assessment that I was extremely passionate about. And I couldn't find anybody. So there was a coffee shop. They had a tagline that said, "A lot can happen over coffee." And I said, I went up to their marketing head, somehow found a way. And I told her, if a lot can happen over coffee, why not conversations about people and their lives? And she said, "Yeah, that sounds good." That's how I got my first gig. And then, you know, we tied up with them. And then I kept analyzing people over coffee. And that was the beginning.
Wow. Amazing. So tell us a little bit about the logistics of that. So did you go and work from the coffee shop or how did that work?
Yeah, I worked from a coffee shop. My first payment, if I have to break it down in pound, was half a pound, which is like 50 rupees. And I still remember my first person I walked up to and had a conversation with on my first day of that job or that collaboration was a foreigner. And she said, "Can I tip you?" And nobody had ever tipped me. And I didn't understand what does that mean. And she was being kind because she really liked what I said about her. And I'm like, "No, you can't do it because culturally, we don't know what it means to be tipped. It is not always like the appreciative thing. Is sometimes you feel probably in a different strata." So I remember feeling very embarrassed and confused. So that was the beginning. After that, thankfully, I sustained that for a couple of months, one year probably. And then I got my first radio show. Again, I walked up to a radio station, spoke to them. They liked it. And they said, "Let's experiment." And the experiment worked. And then I had a radio show and people couldn't see how young I was behind the mic. So they thought I'm this old woman who would talk about their life. So they kept booking appointments and then they would walk into my little appointment place, not even my office, and would say, "Where is your boss?" And I would say, "I am the boss. Who do you want to talk to?" You're like, "Oh, we were expecting somebody at least 40 years old. I'm like, "That's me. Let me talk to you about yourself." And that's how life started.
So breaking down all sort of barriers of typical stereotypes and obviously your cultural environment, the way that you were brought up, how did that then shape into your understanding of sort of behavior and productivity in the workplace. So how did that transition from doing, you know, people's stories and into the work and environment?
I think both of you can relate to this idea that when you analyze people, immediately the next question they would ask you is, so what do I do to change it, fix it? And I realize I'm just 19 and I have no context of telling them, no experience or no framework. And that was the first time I felt if I want to become more successful in the field I have chosen and also prove my dad wrong, which was playing at the back of my mind then, I need to have some sort of framework. So I went about studying different psychometric tools, gathered money to do all the international certifications available, and then slowly, steadily built my own understanding on if you can analyze a person, how softly and how assertively can you present an alternate idea for them to make shift in their behavior. And as the research went about, something that I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoy even now, that studying people, studying businesses, and then figuring out what can I change in the behavior to change the business results. And now that's my specialization. So more than productivity, which is mostly understood as time management, I believe it's about energy management. And when, if one can shift the energy to suit their own personality, people are extremely productive. But if you do all the productive things that are not matching who you are, then you might do all the right thing, but you're not happy and you're not energized by the activities that you do. So I think most people don't think about it. And that's the biggest gap that we have.
I love that concept. We talk about energy a lot. Obviously, we're kindred spirits in this. And I think, you know, we have a bit of a pet peeve around the word balance. And, you know,
Yes. Oh, God. every time people say, so what is work-life balance?
Oh, my gosh.
There's nothing called work-life balance.
No, there's not.
I love the quote by Alan de Botton, if I'm not wrong. And he says, anything that is worth loving would push you off balance and it's worth doing it. Yes, that's the truth.
And I think that's we talk a lot about energy around, it's not about the number of hours you work. So going back to your time piece before, if you're working in line with your behaviors, doing things that bring you energy, you as a result will feel more balanced than someone who maybe works less. It's where all this, we could get into so much, unfortunately, we've only got so long in a podcast, I'm sure, with you around, you know, the 4-day working week and things like that. And all of these experiments are based on time. And actually, if we can just get people to work in line with their behaviors and in line with their energy, that's where you really see the productivity and performance gains, not in, can I squeeze the work that I'm doing into 4 days? Or can I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and am I most productive in the first 2 hours before 7 a.m.? It's actually not about time, it's about energy. So I love that you said that.
So I always narrate a story when it comes to this discussion. You know, for example, one day, hopefully we meet for a cup of coffee and we see a man running. Now, people mostly judge and assess anybody's progress on the basis of how far this person has gone and how fast he was running. But the motive behind the run could be anything. Imagine there's a dog behind. And Sarah may say, okay, there's a dog. And that's why he's running. And we say, oh, but we can't see any dog. And probably Laura would say, oh, but there might be a kite in the sky. And, you know, we are discussing. And as we go about, the coffee server comes and he says, no, he's a regular customer. He's preparing for a marathon. So depending on the motive behind the run, his experience would be completely different. There's a dog, it's fear-based. When there's a kite, it's greed-based. And in both these situations, he doesn't know where he's running. He's only focused on just dealing with these external triggers. But when he's preparing for a marathon, not running in one, then he would run because he loves running. He would probably listen to his favorite music, would wear shoes that he likes, choose a track, running track that he wants to go, and probably say hello to people around. Now, all of these things would make him feel more excited about the run and not just do it for the heck of reaching somewhere or getting rid of something. Now, most working generation that we see, they are either running because they want to get to that next promotion or they want to service their loans. And I have seen this across cultures and I've seen this in different parts of the world. And coming from India, I always feel, oh, probably it would be different when the countries are developing and developed. And it's not true. Even developed countries have bigger challenges, and people are stuck in their own traps created by different capitalist ideas around them. And people just keep running and running and running, and they expect themselves to be happy on the weekend, maybe.
Yeah, it's such an interesting concept. I think our profiling tool does assess what your motivations are in the work environment. And I think it's one of the things we go back to time and time again, like someone who's motivated to do something and is able to get up and come to work and feel motivated, and you're playing them in a position that motivates them, is A, going to create a better working environment, but also they're going to be happy whilst they're doing it. And the last thing we want, really, you spend so much time at work, a lot of us do anyway, that we don't want people to be living just for the weekend, because it's kind of, it's no existence at all if that's all that you're turning up to do. I think that's actually a really nice story, a way of explaining it. From your standpoint, you've worked with some huge global leaders, coaching, you know, some really big players. Reoccurring behavioral patterns or challenges, what do they look like for you? What have you noticed in like really high performing professionals?
You know, it might sound counterintuitive, but they're very curious. I haven't seen, you know, any high performer being like, oh, I got this, or like, don't barge into my space, or like, you know, even resisting to the ideas that make them uncomfortable. And I'm sure it's a lot about how they're presented. And if they don't trust you, they won't buy that idea and won't be open to it. But once they're open, they're extremely curious and willing to try new things, which unfortunately I do not see with people who are more fixed-minded or a perfectionist kind. They're not open to new ideas. And that I have seen across. Second thing is willingness to be wrong. They're okay being wrong. And sometimes in on my podcast, this has happened, people would talk about, I would open the conversation to ask questions. And people would talk about such personal things on a podcast. And I also do video podcasts, which is just like, and sometimes they would ask the question and my heart would sing, saying, how are they asking this on a public platform? But they're okay to be wrong or humiliated or trolled maybe. And I feel that's such a courageous quality to have. And I've learned so much from them. Third thing is that they don't focus on not failing, but they focus on recovering fast. Because they know they're going to fail, and they know this, you know, they don't have all the answers. As I said, they're curious and they're experimenting. So they're focused on recovering faster. And I think that's such a telling trait always.
I think that's interesting around. We were talking the other day with a guy who leads a really successful business, and he talks a lot about that fail fast but bounce back, and actually just not getting so caught up in the ego that I think sometimes leaders fall into, of like, oh, I made that mistake, and almost wanting to maybe prove the mistake wrong or not admit that they made a mistake, that then causes you to drag out that failure, as opposed to just saying, you know what, we made the wrong decision, we failed there, let's just nip it in the bud now and not drag it out for another 6 months, and actually just move on from it and take the lesson and make sure that it doesn't happen again.
So you're talking about not taking your failures personally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? But my experience, it can't happen one way. There's no possibility that you can take your success personally, but you can't take your failure personally. It doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest problem, you know, in the world where we congratulate people all the time for all the achievements. And we have created, you know, this culture across, you know, in this time and era where we think validating someone's insecurities or validation is a good thing to do. But we are creating, like, it's almost like dog training. If somebody does something good, you validate. And if they do something wrong, you kind of like give that negative feedback. But we are human beings. We are not dogs. But we are treated like that, right? Like, you know, so only talking about like the positive aspects. So it's lopsided as an idea. So if we really, truly want to not take our success personally, we have to train ourselves to not take our success personally. And in Sanskrit, there is a phrase which goes like idam na mama, which means this is not mine.
Yeah, it's about that separation of identity from the role, right? So your role is your job.
People praise you. You tell yourself, idam na mama, this is not mine. When they criticize you, you say, idam na mama, this is not mine. So then you can focus on the actions that you took to get this result, which went well or which did not go well. But you constantly keep reminding, and I think that has been my mantra, idam na mama, I keep saying that.
Yeah, and it's similar. We talk a little bit about, when we're talking about how to have productive conversations, we talk about ideological challenge, so challenging the idea rather than the person. So you make it less about the person, because we are hardwired to take critique personally, to make it focus more around the idea. But it's actually quite a tricky practice. You've got to build that habit and obviously be super careful about the language that you use, because if someone's bringing something to the table, often you will see you, or you'll point to them, or you'll challenge them. And then often that's where the conflict comes in, or people feel like if their idea wasn't chosen, or if they've been asked for feedback, but the opposite happens, that they take that as a real personal hit.
Or they... I like that thing about it's not mine, because they then make the positive feedback equal I am good, and the negative feedback equals I am bad. And actually, it's not about you. Your identity is separate to the job that you have, the relationships that you have around you. It's actually, that's something that happened to you. And if you can almost watch the roller coaster go around the track, as opposed to sit in the front seat of it and feel it all, then how much more productive would you be?
That's a hard thing to do when you want to drive accountability. You know, if you're driving accountability in a business and you want people to take ownership of the things that they're doing, how do we get that balance right?
Oh, you can actually. So many of the conversations that I would have with my clients or my team, I would always bring. So there are four stages of listening that we go through. Right? One is open-minded, or one is closed-minded, that we all know, like, you're not open to the other idea. And me think greater is open-minded, which is still operating from the mind and still being hearing the other person. Third one is called open-hearted. So when you hear somebody, you also understand where they're coming from. And the fourth one that I really, really like is open-willed. So you're open and willing to be wrong when the other person presents a good idea. So when I talk to my team members, I would sit them down, something has gone wrong. I would say, okay, this is a problem in front of us, and you and I are a team. So let's figure out, this went wrong, or we lost money, or this decision costed us whatever amount of money. Now, as a team, let's figure out what do we require to change here. Now, if you do it, like, and if it becomes part of your DNA, people feel less threatened to accept that they went wrong. Like sometimes one of my team members would say, yeah, I think that's okay. And I'm like, no, it's not okay. Like, you know, I should be saying this as a boss or as your leader. But she only on her own would say, oh, I think that's okay. I will figure it out, and I will change this, and I will change that. But when you make mistakes acceptable, I think you change the relationship to failure. And you can only do that by demonstrating it over and over again. And sometimes that means talking about, oh, I failed. I'm so sorry. I made a mistake here. I think I could have done this. I could have done that. When you demonstrate that by not criticizing yourself for going wrong, but figuring out solutions, people also pick that up. And that becomes the vibe or so-called culture of the organization. And people are extremely accountable in that space, because they are comfortable telling you that, oh my God, I forgot this, and I should have spoken to this client, and I made a mistake. I say, okay, fine, let me send a reminder, because you and I are a team and we are solving a problem. So the problem is in front of us, but it's not in between us. So I think that has been very powerful for me.
Thinking about where the problem is placed, isn't it? And I think that's often a blind spot that not just leaders, but I think people in general have at work. There's often that fear there, which makes problems feel either insurmountable or that they are between you and someone else, whether that's between you and a leader, between you and the wider team. What other blind spots, Aditi, have you seen when you work with leaders that are maybe average performers as opposed to high performers? What do you think some of those, or what have you experienced some of those blind spots to be?
First, it's always about the ego related traits, where you feel that I need to be proven right, I need to look good, and the job of my work or the objective of this everything that I'm doing in my career is to be proven correct. If that's somebody's outlook, then they're focused on themselves and not the contribution or the skill building or trying something new or experimenting. That does not happen. And self-orientation to a certain degree is a good thing, but after a point, it destroys and reduces the trustworthiness that the person carries. And that's what happens, you know, when a person with extremely high self-orientation would go and talk to multiple people or work with them regularly, other people never feel calm or they can't relax their nerve around this person. And that's a detrimental thing to happen to any team for that matter. So they might be running because there are many dogs and they fear that this boss or this leader are gonna reprimand me and I have to go around it. So they might perform really well, but I feel that's still an average performance for a leader. It's a very, very common trait I have seen.
And I think that tallies up with there's two behaviors that we talk about where someone's more internal. So their source of reference is themselves as opposed to others. And then they are potentially more power driven, where actually their drive is a need to be seen to lead. And if you've got those two behavioral traits, it doesn't mean that you can't let go of that ego piece. You absolutely can with the right self-awareness and with the right coaching. But for people who have both of those, that can definitely be trickier. And it's certainly a blind spot that they then need to make sure that they counterbalance. Whereas when you've got behaviors, you know, for you, you've got kind of the opposite to those two, that you have a high people orientation and there's a big piece in you that wants to others to feel heard. And I think that, you know, when leaders have got that, it's easier to flex that. So it's just being aware of where do you have those blind spots and what might be the counterbalance to those. If you're interested in learning more about your own management behaviors and the behaviors of your team, click the link in the show notes to access a 14-day free trial of Perform.
Another trait I have found is not solving a problem for others. Yeah, it's just sitting with the problem and, you know, letting the other person. And some really empathetic leaders fail to do that. Thereby, they become the problems for the team. You know, they can't take the person sulking or struggling. They're like, okay, I pushed too hard, and they start feeling guilty about it. But it's your job to challenge your team members and push them a little bit off their comfort zone and then be around, but let them go through the grind. Because if you make it easy, you are not letting your team members grow. And if you have a younger generation like Gen Z that you are hiring, you got to be somebody who is inspiring because they want to come back for stimulation. They don't want to come back for money or routine or security. So these kind of leaders struggle when they have to work with younger generation because they don't know how to challenge them. They are always being like the fixer or the protector. And they're really good. You know, they're good leaders. It's just that if you're not a challenger, talented people can't find their way around you.
Yeah, that difference. Last week, I was actually doing some delivery around the difference between emotional intelligence and EQ against IQ. And one of the things we're actually debating was the balance between, you know, the empathy piece and some people with really, really strong people behaviors, where actually it can be detrimental if you're not managing that right, because you can be over empathetic and then you start to dive in and give the solutions and actually you need the other person to be able to elevate and think for themselves, which I know is a big focus of yours, this growth mindset piece. And how do we encourage people to have a more growth mindset? And you founded India's first mental fitness gym, which kind of focuses on that growth mindset and workplace behavior and productivity. Tell us a little bit about that and how that's landed in your culture.
Oh, not well, actually. So I'm an accidental content creator. When COVID hit India, I had already read some research papers about what happened in Europe and how people's mental health got affected. And before that, in 2019, I took out some time and I wrote the manuscript for my first book, which was around anxiety. So when this happened, I'm like, oh my God, I have all this material available with me. And what if I die? And that thought was so real because, you know, you had no clue. So I told my team, we're just going to start an Instagram live series for 21 days and I'm going to give away all the material I have written. And they're like, but that's a book and you must not and all of that. But in a couple of days, I'm like, you know, there's no guarantee that one gets to publish this now. So I might as well teach it. So people who are supposed to receive it must receive it. And with that thought, I jumped in and little that I knew, that initiative reached 40,000 people in the next 3 years. And people would ask me questions, okay, if I have this problem, what do I do? And they were so lonely and they were like struggling. And many people lost their jobs. So all of us know what happened. So in that period, as a knee-jerk reaction, whatever I had started became like a little movement in itself. And I started speaking a lot about calmness. And I realized people, and everybody is focusing so much on physical fitness, doing workouts online, everything, you know, baking cakes, maybe banana breads, but nobody was focusing on doing regular workouts for their minds to be okay. And this is where the idea came. Oh, mental fitness gym, you know, how you go to the gym, you will do that. For 2 years, we ran the project, which was very, very nice. But sooner than later, I realized that people are not talking about it because they feel a little ashamed to accept the fact that I go to a mental gym. We do have that stigma and it is reducing and we're getting better, but still the stigma is there. So then I was selected in some women entrepreneurship program with Goldman Sachs in 2022. And that time I presented this idea to my mentors and you know how they ask you questions that you don't have an answer for. So mentor after mentor kept asking me the same question. And I realized I don't have an answer of how to break the mindset of generations that are around and how to make the mental fitness as a term acceptable. And I was failing. I was failing to make it friendly and acceptable. I was creating content which was funny and friendly. And I was, you know, using Bollywood references to it. But in spite of all of this, I was not seeing what I thought I would see. So then came a moment where I accepted probably I need to redesign this idea. So I took some time off and after like 6 months, I came back with the newer proposition, which is around growth mindset. And I now currently run a mentorship program called Find Your Greatness, where people go through a journey for 100 days and they take up some projects and they have 12 themes that they learn. But all of this is toward growth mindset. And it's not towards like fixing a problem that people feel intimidated by, though that's exactly what happens. But for some reason, people find it's nice when you say, oh, I want to find my greatness versus I want to be mentally fit. So we said, okay, fine, like let's reword or reorient what we are doing in that sense to create the awareness that we want to.
I think that's lovely. And I think, I mean, it's a great positioning exercise, isn't it? That I think sometimes with these sorts of things and behavior and culture and high performance, a lot of the time you are before your time or before people are really recognizing and feeling that pain. Can you give us some real life examples of where you think that mental fitness, growth mindset piece has led to significant behavioral transformation in either an individual or in a business? Because I think some people still think that's a nice to have. And actually we know through the work we do, as I'm sure you've seen, is it actually leads to huge transformations. Have you got any examples of that?
Oh, so many. So let me tell you about one business owner whose company owned by his father that he took over as, you know, family managed business owner, went to bankruptcy. Now he was at 45. That is like a public failure. He didn't know anything else in life. And how do you make sense of the situation? And it was not even his fault. There are certain situational changes, government law changes, because of which he couldn't have survived. Now he's sitting there thinking about his life. And when I analyzed his personality, I found certain behavioral elements which were about creativity, about operational excellence, and about constantly growing and challenging himself. And I was looking for one thing that, you know, can fit all of it. One day he landed up talking about the flowers in his driveway. And I thought, probably nice. He said, oh, I got some sunflowers. And I said, that's sweet. He said, let me send you a photo. He was very, very excited about it. And then I knew that he had 500 sunflower pots in his driveway. I'm like, what's this? And he said, oh, I love flowers. And then after that 15 minutes, he only spoke about his flowers and sent me 32 photos. And when I looked at it, I'm like, okay. Next session, I spoke about what if we start a business in premium flowers? And he was extremely resistant to that idea. He said, no, I can't do this. You know, it's probably what I would get from my vendor or my farmhouses that everything happened. But I was very clear about he needed to grow by picking up something that energizes him, something that brings in joy every single day. And this has been 4 years. He finally caved in and started a business. And that business has been extremely successful. He's one of the most premium luxury brands in the space of floral decor. And he's been doing great. And every time I look at him, he fails a lot, but he gets up because of the growth mindset that he learned. He almost anticipates that if I fall, this is all I'm going to do. But I would not take it personally, no matter what. In that most embarrassing situation of failure, like bankruptcy, when he decided to start something new while dealing with all the challenges that he was going through, that created a kind of experiment that shifted his mindset forever. So is it easy? Absolutely not, to build something. And half of the work happened during COVID. So it was really, really tough for him. But it is so energizing because of the mindset that he has adopted.
And also focusing on something that you're passionate about. Obviously, yes, you wake up every day feeling passionate in the first instance. So the passion and the energy can take you further than if you're doing something and it's, you know, sometimes when you inherit a business, and I'm not talking about this particular person, but when you have a legacy around you because you've been handed something.
So much pressure.
Yeah, so much pressure. But often you find yourself in a situation where you know, you feel like you don't have any choices. And sometimes it's a bit like when you get made redundant, or if something bad happens, you've got almost the freedom to do something that maybe is more centric to you, where you can make those choices yourself. It's a really lovely story. And I think the transformational piece is, it's not easy. If it was easy, everybody would be doing it. You know, often the biggest things come from the things where you're pushed in your growth zone, you manage to connect with the growth mindset, and you can move forward. But I'm a massive believer, sometimes you need external people to be able to help you find that or see it, which is why, you know, coaches or mentors, or sometimes it can just be people in your circle that can interrupt your thought process and help you make those steps forward.
I feel when people talk about passion profession, they feel they get to do every day what they love to do. And I always tell them, if 30% of your time when you're at work, if you can do something that you love to do, you're extremely lucky, because 70% going to be around that activity, probably writing documents and creating posts or like talking to people or like paying bills. So 70% activities will be away from what you're passionate about. So passion profession does not mean every day you get to do what you love to do. But I feel that 30% of the time you get to do is enough, and it compensates for everything else. Like every time I think about coaching, I blush, and I can't stop. Like, I don't know how, it's been 20 years, but I blush. There's like a very, very different kind of emotion you have. But if that is what your love affair with your work is, then 30% of the time is enough to don't even expect it to be 100, is what I'm trying to say.
I mean, the optimist in me makes me want to feel like I'm going to flip that and want to do 70%. But
the realist tells her that that's not going to happen.
That's totally true. That's totally true.
You know, it's so funny. Like everything that we are resonating on, I'm like, who are these people from a different part of the world? And we're like matching. Why matter so many things?
Yeah, kindred spirits.
Absolutely. So we're going to do a little rapid fire round. We're going to get some quick answers from you on a few things that I think the listeners will be interested in. So first one is going to be, which one workplace behavior that drives you crazy? What would it be?
Oh, when people just be okay with mediocrity.
Yes.
That's a good one. Yeah. What's the book that's had the biggest influence on your approach to productivity?
Mindset by Carol Dweck, hands on.
Okay, we'll put that in the show notes in case people want to have a look at it. Your favorite productivity hack for busy people?
You are never busy. It's just that it is not your priority. So just sit down and think about 6 things that you will be completing in a day. Don't try to be a superhuman and think about 30 things, just 6 things, and keep going back to it with all your distractions. And if you finish that 7 days in a row, then you know that that's your capacity. And if you can't, you know that's your capacity.
I love that. That's going to be my mantra now. Anybody tells me they're busy, I'm going to go, you're not. You're just not prioritizing. One leader or professional who's inspired your journey?
I think that would be Priyanka Chopra, an Indian actor who made a global impact. And I feel because I know how tough it is for an Indian woman to survive in the culture which does not accept you, and then you make a mark and then you do it again. And you say, you know, I'm going to walk up to people in a different country and introduce myself and begin again. And I know how tough it is, and I relate to that. So Priyanka Chopra.
The listeners won't know this, or most of them maybe won't, that you actually do some acting yourself. Is that right?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit quickly about that.
So I became a behavioral analyst because I wanted to be an actor. And my father told me, please go and observe people. You'll find all your characters as an actor in them. So I just started observing them and came a little too far on that journey and became an analyst. But over and over again, I kept going back to the exploration of acting as a physical emoting tool, because as analysts, we can be very, very cognitive about the whole thing. And I had the sense about body-mind connection. So I use acting tools to kind of practice that for myself more than teaching. And then this year I turned 40, and last year I had this epiphany. I'm like, if I don't pick up acting that I like so much, I would probably never be able to do this. So I started my training again, and I did my first short film this year, and I did my first TV commercial this year. So I don't know what I have in store, but I am curious and I'm excited to see and explore what happens along with the work that I do, of course.
Amazing. That's a good way of, that's a good example of aligning energy and not being too focused on balance, doing all of the things that bring you energy. So last question, if there was one behavioral principle that every manager or leader should master, what would it be and why?
It would be put yourself into a grind or uncomfortable zone over and over again. And with your skill set and your mindset, that definition of uncomfortable zone would change, but design it for yourself. Because if you don't, you would not stay curious. You would just be bored and the work becomes monotonous. And that's the biggest problem. Because it's not, our work is never monotonous. We are not that interested or engaged. And the only way to do that is create a game out of it. You know, create your own scorecard and just see what happens when you throw yourself in that uncomfortable zone. For example, I would always, being dyslexic, I struggle with languages, and it has been a pattern. But I would like challenge myself to see how many times did I fumble to look for that one word in one conversation. And it is like a mental note game. If I do it 5 times, I would say, okay, probably it's time to start reading out loudly again. So I have like these little exercises that I would do, but I know the scoreboard is my way to know whether I'm going off track or not. And it's my way of playing that game and challenging myself. And if for like probably 7 days I don't have this, then I would challenge myself by memorizing a poetry, which I can't. Like, you know, if memorizing something is really tough. But then I challenge myself and say, how fast did I do it? Or was it fun? So just constantly keeping that game on is something that you can gift yourself. So you don't require a boss, no performance review. You're constantly growing, because that becomes a game.
Amazing. What a lovely message to end on. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We have loved having someone who is on our wavelength with us for the last 40 minutes. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So let's wrap up with some takeaways from Aditi's episode. So the first has to be that phrase about it's not mine. And actually, managers and leaders having the ability to separate their failures and successes and not make them personal. So a bad result doesn't equal that you are bad, or a good result doesn't equal that you are good. They can be viewed separately. We also talked about energy management versus time management. And actually, for true productivity, you need to focus less on time and more on how you work in line with that energy. And finally, really speaking our language, we talked about you have to be able to change behavior to change business results. So it's not enough just to look at a desired result if you can't then change and align the behavior that it's going to take to deliver that result.
Thank you for listening to Misbehave. Follow us so you don't miss out on other episodes.